Side 3. Ellie returned to the sky survey mode of Project Argus. Again, no pattern. It was like a musician listening to the rumble of a distant thunderstorm. The occasional small patches of pattern would pursue her and intrude themselves into her memory with such insistence that sometimes she was forced to go back to the tapes of a particular observing run to see if there was something her mind had caught and the computers had missed. All her life, dreams had been her friends. Her dreams were unusually detailed, well-structured, colorful. She was able to peer closely at her father's face, say, or the back of an old radio set, and the dream would oblige with full visual details. She had always been able to recall her dreams down to the fine details, except for the times when she had been under extreme pressure, as before her PhD oral exam, or when she and Jesse were breaking up. But now she was having difficulty recalling the images in her dreams. And disconcertingly, she began to dream sounds, as people do who are blind from birth. In the early morning hours, her unconscious mind would generate some theme or ditty she had never heard before. She would wake up, give an audible command to the light on her night table, pick up the pen she had put there for the purpose, draw a staff, and commit the music to paper. Sometimes, after a long day, she would play it on her recorder and wonder if she had heard it in Ophiuchus or Capricorn. She was, she would admit to herself ruefully, being haunted by the electrons and the moving holes that inhabit receivers and amplifiers, and by the charged particles and magnetic fields of the cold, thin gas between the flickering distant stars. It was a repeated single note, high-pitched and raucous around the edges. It took her a moment to recognize it. Then she was sure she hadn't heard it in 35 years. It was the metal pulley on the clothesline that would complain each time her mother gave a tug and put out another freshly washed smock to dry in the sun. As a little girl, she had loved the army of marching clothespins, and when no one was about, would bury her face in the newly dried sheets. The smell, at once sweet and pungent, enchanted her. Could that be a whiff of it now? She could remember herself laughing, toddling away from the sheets when her mother in one graceful motion swooped her up to the sky, it seemed, and carried her away in the crook of her arm, as if she herself were just a little bundle of clothes to be neatly arranged in the chest of drawers in her parents' bedroom.
Dr. Arroway? Dr. Arroway?
The technician looked down on her fluttering eyelids and shallow breathing. She blinked twice, removed the headphones, and gave him a small, apologetic smile. Sometimes her colleagues had to talk very loudly if they wished to be heard above the amplified cosmic radio noise. She would in turn compensate for the volume of the noise. She was loath to remove the earphones for brief conversations by shouting back. When she was sufficiently preoccupied, a casual or even convivial exchange of pleasantries would seem to an inexperienced observer like a fragment of a fierce and unprovoked argument, unexpectedly generated amidst the quiet of the vast radio facility. But now she only said,
"Sorry, I must have drifted off. It's Dr. Drumlin on the phone. He's in Jack's office and says he has an appointment with you."
Oh, holy smoke, I forgot. As the years had passed, Drumlin's brilliance had remained undiminished. But there were a number of additional personal idiosyncrasies that had not been in evidence when she had served briefly as his graduate student at Caltech. For example, he had the disconcerting habit now of checking, when he thought himself unobserved, whether his fly was open. He had, over the years, become increasingly convinced that extraterrestrials did not exist, or at least that they were too rare, too distant to be detected. He had come to Argus to give the weekly scientific colloquium. But she found he had come for another purpose as well. He had written a letter to the National Science Foundation, urging that Argus terminate its search for extraterrestrial intelligence and devote itself full-time to more conventional radio astronomy. He produced it from an inside pocket and insisted that she read it. "But we've only been at it 4.5 years. We've looked at less than a third of the northern sky. This is the first survey that can do the entire radio noise minimum at optimum band passes. Why would you want to stop now?"
No, Ellie. This is endless. After a dozen years, you'll find no sign of anything. You'll argue that another Argus facility has to be built at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars in Australia or Argentina to observe the southern sky. And when that fails, you'll talk about building some paraboloid with a free-flying feed in Earth orbit so you can get millimeter waves. You'll always be able to think of some kind of observation that hasn't been done. You'll always invent some explanation about why the extraterrestrials like to broadcast where we haven't looked. Now, Dave, we've been through this 100 times. If we fail, we learn something of the rarity of intelligent life. Or at least intelligent life that thinks like we do and wants to communicate with backward civilizations like us. And if we succeed, we hit the cosmic jackpot. There's no greater discovery you can imagine.
There are first-rate projects that aren't finding telescope time. There's work on quasar evolution, binary pulsars, the chromospheres of nearby stars, even those crazy interstellar proteins. These projects are waiting in line because this facility, by far the best phased array in the world, is being used almost entirely for SETI.
75% for SETI, Dave, 25% for routine radio astronomy.
Don't call it routine. We've got the opportunity to look back to the time that the galaxies were being formed, or maybe even earlier than that. We can examine the cores of giant molecular clouds and the black holes at the centers of galaxies. There's a revolution in astronomy about to happen, and you're standing in the way.
Dave, try not to personalize this. Argus would never have been built if there wasn't public support for SETI. The idea for Argus isn't mine. You know they picked me as director when the last 40 dishes were still under construction. The NSF is entirely behind...
Not entirely. And not if I have anything to say about it. This is grandstanding. This is pandering to UFO kooks and comic strips and weak-minded adolescents.
By now, Drumlin was fairly shouting, and Ellie felt an irresistible temptation to tune him out. Because of the nature of her work and her comparative eminence, she was constantly thrown into situations where she was the only woman present, except for those serving coffee or making a stenotypic transcript. Despite what seemed like a lifetime of effort on her part, there was still a host of male scientists who only talked to each other, insisted on interrupting her, and ignored when they could what she had to say. Occasionally, there were those like Drumlin who showed a positive antipathy. But at least he was treating her as he did many men. He was even-handed in his outbursts, visiting them equally on scientists of both sexes. There were a rare few of her male colleagues who did not exhibit awkward personality changes in her presence. She ought to spend more time with them, she thought. People like Kenneth Trahere, the molecular biologist from the Salk Institute, who had recently been appointed presidential science advisor, and Peter Valerian, of course. Drumlin's impatience with Argus, she knew, was shared by many astronomers. After the first 2 years, a kind of melancholy had pervaded the facility. There were passionate debates in the commissary or during the long and undemanding watches about the intentions of the putative extraterrestrials. We could not guess how different from us they might be. It was hard enough to guess the intentions of our elected representatives in Washington. What would the intentions be of fundamentally different kinds of beings on physically different worlds, hundreds or thousands of light years away? Some believed that the signal would not be transmitted in the radio spectrum at all, but in the infrared, or the visible, or somewhere among the gamma rays. Or perhaps the extraterrestrials were signaling avidly, but with a technology we would not invent for 1,000 years. Astronomers at other institutions were making extraordinary discoveries among the stars and galaxies, picking out those objects which, by whatever mechanism, generated intense radio waves. Other radio astronomers published scientific papers, attended meetings, were uplifted by a sense of progress and purpose. The Argus astronomers tended not to publish, and were usually ignored when the call went out for invited papers at the annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society, or the triennial symposia and plenary sessions of the International Astronomical Union. So, in consultation with the National Science Foundation, the leadership at Argus had reserved
25% of the observing time for projects unconnected with the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Some important discoveries had been made on the extragalactic objects that seemed paradoxically to be moving faster than light, on the surface temperature of Neptune's big moon, Triton, and on the dark matter in the outer reaches of nearby galaxies where no stars could be seen. Morale began to improve. The Argus staff felt they were making a contribution at the cutting edge of astronomical discovery. The time to complete a full search of the sky had been lengthened, it was true. But now their professional careers had some safety net. They might not succeed in finding signs of other intelligent beings, but they might pluck other secrets from the treasury of nature. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, everywhere abbreviated SETI, except by those who talked somewhat more optimistically about communication with extraterrestrial intelligence, CETI, was essentially an observing routine, the dull staple for which most of the facility had been built. But a quarter of the time, you could be assured of using the most powerful array of radio telescopes on Earth for other projects. You had only to get through the boring part. A small amount of time had also been reserved for astronomers from other institutions. While the morale had improved noticeably, there were many who agreed with Drumlin. They glanced longingly at the technological miracle that Argus's 131 radio telescopes represented, and imagined using them for their own, doubtless meritorious programs. She was alternately conciliatory and argumentative with Dave, but none of it did any good. He was not in an amiable mood. Drumlin's colloquium was in part an attempt to demonstrate that there were no extraterrestrials anywhere. If we had accomplished so much in only a few thousand years of high technology, what must a truly advanced species, he asked, be capable of? They should be able to move stars about, to reconfigure galaxies. And yet, in all of astronomy, there was no sign of a phenomenon that could not be understood by natural processes, for which an appeal to extraterrestrial intelligence had to be made. Why hadn't Argus detected a radio signal by now? Did they imagine just one radio transmitter in all of the sky? Did they realize how many billions of stars they had examined already? The experiment was a worthy one, but now it was over. They didn't have to examine the rest of the sky. The answer was in. Neither in deepest space nor near the Earth was there any sign of extraterrestrials. They did not exist. In the question period, one of the Argus astronomers asked about the zoo hypothesis, the contention that the extraterrestrials were out there all right, but chose not to make their presence known, in order to conceal from humans the fact that there were other intelligent beings in the cosmos. In the same sense that a specialist in primate behavior might wish to observe a troop of chimpanzees in the bush, but not interfere with their activities. In reply, Drumlin asked a different question. Is it likely that with a million civilizations in the galaxy, the sort of number he said was bandied about at Argus, there would not be a single poacher? How does it come about that every civilization in the galaxy abides by an ethic of non-interference? Is it probable that not one of them would be poking around on the Earth? But on Earth, Ellie replied, poachers and game wardens have roughly equal levels of technology. If the game warden is a major step ahead, with radar and helicopters, say, then the poachers are out of business. The remark was greeted warmly by some of the Argus staff. But Drumlin only said, "You're reaching, Ellie. You're reaching." To clear her head, it was her practice to go for long solo drives in her one extravagance, a carefully maintained 1957 Thunderbird with removable hardtop and little glass portholes flanking the rear seat. Often she would leave the top at home and speed through the scrub desert at night, with the windows down and her dark hair streaming behind her. Over the years, it seemed she had gotten to know every small impoverished town, every butte and mesa, and every state highway patrolman in southwestern New Mexico. After a night observing run, she would love to zoom past the Argus guard station, that was before the cyclone fencing went up, rapidly changing gears and drive north.
Around Santa Fe, the faintest glimmerings of dawn might be seen above the Sangre de Cristo mountains. Why should a religion, she asked herself, name its places after the blood and body, heart and pancreas of its most revered figure? And why not the brain, among other prominent but uncommemorated organs? This time she drove southeast, toward the Sacramento Mountains. Could Dave be right? Could SETI and Argus be a kind of collective delusion of a few insufficiently hard-nosed astronomers? Was it true that no matter how many years went by without the receipt of a message, the project would continue, always inventing a new strategy for the transmitting civilization, continually devising novel and expensive instrumentation? What would be a convincing sign of failure? When would she be willing to give up and turn to something safer, something more guaranteed of results? The Nobeyama Observatory in Japan had just announced the discovery of adenosine, a complex organic molecule, a building block of DNA, sitting out there in a dense molecular cloud. She could certainly busy herself usefully in looking for life-related molecules in space, even if she gave up searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. On the high mountain road, she glanced at the southern horizon and caught a glimpse of the constellation Centaurus. In that pattern of stars, the ancient Greeks had seen a chimerical creature, half man, half horse, who had taught Zeus wisdom. But Ellie could never make out any pattern remotely like a centaur. It was Alpha Centauri, the brightest star in the constellation that she delighted in. It was the nearest star, only 4.25 light years away. Actually, Alpha Centauri was a triple system, two suns tightly orbiting one another, and a third, more remote, circling them both. From Earth, the three stars blended together to form a solitary point of light. On particularly clear nights like this one, she could sometimes see it hovering somewhere over Mexico. Sometimes, when the air had been laden with desert grit after several consecutive days of sandstorms, she would drive up into the mountains to gain a little altitude and atmospheric transparency, get out of the car and stare at the nearest star system. Planets were possible there, although very hard to detect. Some might be closely orbiting any one of the triple suns. A more interesting orbit, with some fair celestial mechanical stability, was a figure eight, which wrapped itself around the two inner suns. What would it be like, she wondered, to live on a world with three suns in the sky? Probably even hotter than New Mexico. The two-lane blacktop highway, Ellie noticed, with a pleasant little tremor, was lined with rabbits. She had seen them before, especially when her drives had taken her as far as West Texas. They were on all fours by the shoulders of the road, but as each would be momentarily illuminated by the Thunderbird's new quartz headlights, it would stand on its hind legs, its forelimbs hanging limply, transfixed. For miles there was an honor guard of desert conies saluting her, so it seemed, as she roared through the night. They would look up, 1,000 pink noses twitching, 2,000 bright eyes shining in the dark, as this apparition hurtled toward them. Maybe it's a kind of religious experience, she thought. They seemed to be mostly young rabbits. Maybe they had never seen automobile headlights. To think of it, it was pretty amazing, the two intense beams of light speeding along at 130 kilometers an hour. Despite the thousands of rabbits lining the road, there never seemed to be even one in the middle, near the lane marker, never a confused scurrying out of the way, never a forlorn dead body, the ears stretched out along the pavement. Why were they aligned along the pavement at all? Maybe it had to do with the temperature of the asphalt, she thought. Or maybe they were only foraging in the scrub vegetation nearby and curious about the oncoming bright light. But was it reasonable that none of them ever took a few short hops to visit his cousins across the road? What did they imagine the highway was? An alien presence in their midst, its function unfathomable, built by creatures that most of them had never seen. She doubted that any of them wondered about it at all. The whine of her tires on the highway was a kind of white noise, and she found that, involuntarily, she was here too, listening for a pattern. She had taken to listening closely to many sources of white noise. The motor of the refrigerator starting up in the middle of the night. The water running for her bath. The washing machine when she would do her clothes in the little laundry room off her kitchen. The roar of the ocean during a brief scuba diving trip to the island of Cozumel, off Yucatan, which she had cut short because of her impatience to get back to work. She would listen to these everyday sources of random noise and try to determine whether there were fewer apparent patterns in them than in the interstellar static. She had been to New York City the previous August for a meeting of URSI, the French abbreviation for the International Scientific Radio Union. The subways were dangerous, she had been told. But the white noise was irresistible, and the clacka-clacka of this underground railway. She had thought she heard a clue, and resolutely skipped half a day of meetings, traveling from 34th Street to Coney Island, back to Midtown Manhattan, and then on a different line out to remotest Queens. She changed trains at a station in Jamaica, and then returned a little flushed and breathless. It was, after all, a hot day in August, she told herself, to the Convention Hotel. Sometimes, when the subway train was banking around a steep curve, the interior bulbs would go out, and she could see a regular succession of lights glowing in electric blue, speeding by as if she were in some impossible, hyper-relativistic interstellar spacecraft hurtling through a cluster of young blue supergiant stars. Then, as the train entered a straightaway, the interior lights would come on again, and she would become aware once again of the acrid smell, the jostling of nearby strap hangers, the miniature television surveillance cameras, locked in protective cages and subsequently spray-painted blind. The stylized, multicolored map showing the complete underground transportation system of the city of New York and the high-frequency screech of the brakes as they pulled into the stations. This was a little eccentric, she knew, but she had always had an active fantasy life. All right, so she was a little compulsive about listening to noise. It did no harm that she could see. Nobody seemed to notice much. Anyway, it was job-related. If she had been so minded, she could probably have deducted the expense of her trip to Cozumel from her income tax because of the sound of the breakers. Well, maybe she was becoming obsessive. She realized with a start that she had arrived at the Rockefeller Center station. As she quickly stepped out through an accumulation of daily newspapers abandoned on the floor of the subway car, a headline of the news post had caught her eye. "Gorillas capture Joburg radio." If we like them, they're freedom fighters, she thought. If we don't like them, they're terrorists. In the unlikely case we can't make up our minds, they're temporarily only gorillas. On an adjacent scrap of newspaper was a large photo of a florid, confident man with the headline, "How the World Will End, excerpts from the Reverend Billy Joe Rankin's new book, exclusively this week in the News Post." She had taken the headlines in at a glance and tried promptly to forget them. Moving through the bustling crowds to the meeting hotel, she hoped she was in time to hear Fujita's paper on homomorphic radio telescope design. Superposed on the whine of the tires was a periodic thump at the joins of swathes of pavement, which had been resurfaced by different New Mexico road crews in different epochs. What if an interstellar message were being received by Project Argus? But very slowly. One bit of information every hour, say, or every week, or every decade. What if there were very old, very patient murmurs of some transmitting civilization which had no way of knowing that we get tired of pattern recognition after seconds or minutes? Suppose they lived for tens of thousands of years and talked very slowly. Argus would never know. Could such long-lived creatures exist? Would there have been enough time in the history of the universe for creatures who reproduced very slowly to evolve to high intelligence? Wouldn't the statistical breakdown of chemical bonds, The deterioration of their bodies, according to the second law of thermodynamics, forced them to reproduce about as often as human beings do, and to have lifespans like ours? Or might they reside on some old and frigid world, where even molecular collisions occur in extreme slow motion, maybe only a frame a day? She idly imagined a radio transmitter of recognizable and familiar design, sitting on a cliff of methane ice, feebly illuminated by a distant red dwarf sun, while far below waves of an ammonia ocean beat relentlessly against the shore, incidentally generating a white noise, indistinguishable from that of the surf at Cozumel. The opposite was possible as well. The fast talkers, manic little creatures perhaps, moving with quick and jerky motions, who transmitted a complete radio message, the equivalent of hundreds of pages of English text, in a nanosecond. Of course, if you had a very narrow band pass to your receiver, so you were listening only to a tiny range of frequencies, you were forced to accept the long-time constant. You would never be able to detect a rapid modulation. It was a simple consequence of the Fourier integral theorem, and closely related to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So, for example, if you had a band pass of a kilohertz, you couldn't make out a signal that was modulated at faster than a millisecond. It would be a kind of sonic blur. The Argus band passes were narrower than a hertz, so to be detected, the transmitters must be modulating very slowly. Slower than one bit of information a second. Still slower modulations, longer than hours, say, could be detected easily, provided you were willing to point a telescope at the source for that length of time, provided you were exceptionally patient. There were so many pieces of the sky to look at, so many hundreds of billions of stars to search out, you couldn't spend all your time on only a few of them. She was troubled, but in their haste to do a full sky survey in less than a human lifetime, to listen to all of the sky at a billion frequencies, they had abandoned both the frantic talkers and the laconic plotters. But surely, she thought, they would know better than we what modulation frequencies were acceptable. They would have had previous experience with interstellar communication and newly emerging civilizations. If there was a broad range of likely pulse rates that the receiving civilization would adopt, the transmitting civilization would utilize such a range. Modulated microseconds, modulated hours, what would it cost them? They would, almost all of them, have superior engineering and enormous power resources by Earth standards. If they wanted to communicate with us, they would make it easy for us. They would send signals at many different frequencies. They would use many different modulation timescales. They would know how backward we are and would have pity. So why had we received no signal? Could Dave possibly be right? No extraterrestrial civilizations anywhere? All those billions of worlds going to waste, lifeless, barren, intelligent beings growing up only in this obscure corner of an incomprehensibly vast universe? No matter how valiantly she tried, Ellie couldn't make herself take such a possibility seriously. It dovetailed perfectly with human fears and pretensions, with unproved doctrines about life after death, with such pseudosciences as astrology. It was the modern incarnation of the geocentric solipsism, the conceit that had captured our ancestors, the notion that we were the center of the universe. Drumlin's argument was suspect on these grounds alone. We wanted to believe it too badly. Wait a minute, she thought. We haven't even examined the northern skies once with the Argus system. And another 7 or 8 years, if we've still heard nothing, that'll be the time to start worrying. This is the first moment in human history when it's possible to search for the inhabitants of other worlds. If we fail, we've calibrated something of the rarity and preciousness of life on our planet, a fact, if it is one, very much worth knowing. And if we succeed, we'll have changed the history of our species, broken the shackles of provincialism, With the stakes this high, you have to be willing to take some small professional risks, she told herself. She pulled off the side of the road and did a shallow racing turn, changed gears twice, and accelerated back toward the Argus facility. The rabbits, still lining the roadside but now pinked by dawn, craned their necks to follow her departure. Chapter 4 Prime Numbers. Are there no Moravians in the moon, that not a missionary has yet visited this poor pagan planet of ours to civilize civilization and Christianize Christendom? Herman Melville, White Jacket, 1850. Silence alone is great. All else is weakness. Alfred de Vigny, La Mort du Loup, 1864. The cold black vacuum had been left behind. The pulses were now approaching an ordinary yellow dwarf star, and had already begun spilling over the retinue of worlds in this obscure system. They had fluttered by planets of hydrogen gas, penetrated into moons of ice, breached the organic clouds of a frigid world on which the precursors of life were stirring, and swept across a planet a billion years past its prime. Now the pulses were washing against a warm world, blue and white, spinning against the backdrop of the stars. There was life on this world, extravagant in its numbers and variety. There were jumping spiders at the chilly tops of the highest mountains, and sulfur-eating worms in hot vents gushing up through ridges on the ocean floors. There were beings that could live only in concentrated sulfuric acid, and beings that were destroyed by concentrated sulfuric acid, organisms that were poisoned by oxygen, and organisms that could survive only in oxygen, that actually breathed the stuff. A particular life form, with a modicum of intelligence, had recently spread across the planet. They had outposts on the ocean floors and in low-altitude orbit. They had swarmed to every nook and cranny of their small world. The boundary that marked the transition of night into day was sweeping westward, and following its motion, millions of these beings ritually performed their morning ablutions. They donned greatcoats and dhotis, drank brews of coffee, tea, or dandelion, drove bicycles, automobiles, or oxen, and briefly contemplated school assignments, prospects for spring planting, and the fate of the world. The first pulses in the train of radio waves insinuated themselves through the atmosphere and clouds, struck the landscape, and were partially reflected back to space. As the earth turned beneath them, successive pulses arrived, engulfing not just this one planet, but the entire system. Very little of the energy was intercepted by any of the worlds. Most of it passed effortlessly onward, as the yellow star and its attendant worlds plunged in an altogether different direction into the inky dark. Wearing a Dacron jacket displaying the word Marauders above a stylized felt volleyball, the duty officer beginning the night shift approached the control building. A clutch of radio astronomers was just leaving for dinner.
"How long have you guys been looking for little green men? It's more than 5 years, isn't it now, Willie?"
They chided him good-naturedly, but he could detect an edge to their banter.
"Give us a break, Willie," another of them said. "The quasar luminosity program is going great guns, but it's going to take forever if we only have 2% of the telescope time."
"Sure, Jack, sure."
"And Willie, we're looking back toward the origin of the universe. There's a big stake in our program, too.
And we know there's a universe out there. You don't know there's a single little green man.
Take it up with Dr. Arroway. I'm sure she'll be glad to hear your opinion," he replied a little sourly.
The duty officer entered the control area. He made a quick survey of dozens of television screens, monitoring the progress of the radio search. They had just finished examining the constellation Hercules. They had peered into the heart of a great swarm of galaxies far beyond the Milky Way, the Hercules cluster, 100 million light-years away. They had tuned in on M13, a swarm of 300,000 stars, give or take a few, gravitationally bound together, moving in orbit around the Milky Way galaxy 26,000 light-years away. They had examined Ras Algethi, a double system, and Zeta and Lambda Herculis, some stars different from the Sun, some similar to it, all nearby. Most of the stars you can see with the naked eye are less than a few hundred light-years away. They had carefully monitored hundreds of little sectors of the sky within the constellation Hercules at a billion separate frequencies, and they had heard nothing. In previous years, they had searched the constellations immediately west of Hercules, Serpens, Corona Borealis, Boötes, Canis Venatici, and there also they had heard nothing. A few of the telescopes the duty officer could see were devoted to picking up some missed data in Hercules. The remainder were aiming, boresighted, at an adjacent patch of sky, the next constellation east of Hercules. To people in the eastern Mediterranean a few thousand years ago, it had resembled a stringed musical instrument and was associated with the Greek culture hero, Orpheus. It was a constellation named Lyra, the lyre. The computers turned the telescopes to follow the stars in Lyra from star rise to star set, accumulated the radio photons, monitored the health of the telescopes, and processed the data in a format convenient for their human operators. Even one duty officer was something of an indulgence. Walking by a bottle of hard candies, a coffee machine, a sentence in elvish runes out of Tolkien by the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at Stanford, and a bumper sticker reading, "Black holes are out of sight," Willie approached the command console. He nodded pleasantly to the afternoon duty officer, now collecting his notes and preparing to leave for dinner. Because the day's data were conveniently summarized in amber on the master display, there was no need for Willie to inquire about the progress of the preceding hours. "As you can see, nothing much. There was a pointing glitch. At least that's what it looked like, in 49, he said, waving vaguely toward the window. "The quasar bunch freed up the 110s and 120s about an hour ago. They seem to be getting very good data." "Yeah, I heard. They don't understand." His voice trailed off as an alarm light flashed decorously on the console in front of them. On a display marked intensity versus frequency, a sharp vertical spike was rising. "Hey, look, it's a monochromatic signal." Another display labeled intensity versus time showed a set of pulses moving left to right and then off the screen. "Those are numbers," Willie said faintly. "Somebody's broadcasting numbers." "Oh, it's probably some Air Force interference. I saw an AWACS, probably from Kirtland, about 1600 hours. Maybe they're spoofing us for fun." There had been solemn agreements to safeguard at least some radio frequencies for astronomy. But precisely because these frequencies represented a clear channel, the military found them occasionally irresistible. If global war ever came, perhaps the radio astronomers would be the first to know, their windows to the cosmos overflowing with orders to battle management and damage assessment satellites in geosynchronous orbit, and with the transmission of coded launch commands to distant strategic outposts. Even with no military traffic, in listening to a billion frequencies at once, the astronomers had to expect some disruption. Lightning, automobile ignitions, direct broadcast satellites were all sources of radio interference. But the computers had their number, knew their characteristics, and systematically ignored them. To signals that were more ambiguous, the computer would listen with greater care and make sure they matched no inventory of data it was programmed to understand. Every now and then, an electronic intelligence aircraft on a training mission, sometimes with a radar dish coyly disguised as a flying saucer camped on its haunches, would fly by, and Argus would suddenly detect unmistakable signatures of intelligent life. But it would always turn out to be life of a peculiar and melancholy sort. Intelligent to a degree, extraterrestrial, just barely. A few months before, An F-29E with state-of-the-art electronic countermeasures passed overhead at 80,000 feet and sounded the alarms on all 131 telescopes. To the unmilitary eyes of the astronomers, the radio signature had been complex enough to be a plausible first message from an extraterrestrial civilization. But they found the westernmost radio telescope had received the signal a full minute before the easternmost. And it soon became clear that it was an object streaking through the thin envelope of air, surrounding the Earth rather than a broadcast from some unimaginably different civilization in the depths of space. Almost certainly, this one was the same thing. The fingers of her right hand were inserted into five evenly spaced receptacles in a low box on her desk. Since the invention of this device, she was able to save half an hour a week. But there hadn't really been a great deal to do with that extra half hour. "And I was telling Mrs. Yarborough all about it. She's the one in the next bed, now that Mrs. Wertheimer passed on. I don't mean to toot my own horn, but I take a lot of credit for what you've done." "Yes, Mother." She examined the gloss on her fingernails and decided that they needed another minute. Maybe a minute 30. "I was thinking about that time in fourth grade. Remember? When it was pouring and you didn't want to go to school? You wanted me to write a note the next day, saying you'd been out because you were sick. And I wouldn't do it. I said, 'Ellie, apart from being beautiful, the most important thing in the world is an education. You can't do much about being beautiful, but you can do something about an education. Go to school. You never know what you might learn today. Isn't that right?'"
"Yes, Mother."
"But I mean, isn't that what I told you then?"
"Yes, I remember, Mom."
The gloss on her four fingers was perfect, but her thumb still had a dull matte appearance. "So I got your galoshes and your raincoat. It was one of those yellow slickers. Oh, you looked cute as a button in it. And scooted you off to school. And that's the day you couldn't answer a question in Mr. Weisbrod's mathematics class. And you got so furious you marched down to the college library and read up on it until you knew more about it than Mr. Weisbrod. He was impressed. He told me."
"He told you? I didn't know that. When did you talk to Mr. Weisbrod?"
"Oh, it was a parent-teacher meeting. He said to me, 'That girl of yours, she's a spunky one,' or words to that effect. Oh, she got so mad at me, she became a real expert on it." "Expert? That's what he said. I know I told you about it."
Her feet were propped up on a desk drawer as she reclined in the swivel chair. She was stabilized only by her fingers and the varnish machine. She felt the buzzer almost before she heard it and abruptly sat up.
"Mom, I gotta go."
"I'm sure I've told you this story before. You just never pay attention to what I'm saying. Mr. Weisbrod, he was a nice man. You never could see his good side."
"Mom, really, I've got to go. We've caught some kind of bogey."
"Bogey?"
"You know, Mom, something that might be a signal. We've talked about it."
There we are, both of us thinking the other one isn't listening. Like mother, like daughter.
"Bye, Mom."
"I'll let you go if you promise to call me right after."
"Okay, Mom, I promise."
Through the whole conversation, her mother's need and loneliness had elicited in Ellie a wish to end the conversation, to run away. She hated herself for that. End of side 3. Side 4. Briskly she entered the control area and approached the main console.
"Evening, Willie. Steve. Let's see the data."
"Oh, good. Now, where did you tuck away the amplitude plot?"
"Oh, good. Do you have the interferometric position?"
"Okay.
Now, let's see if there's any nearby star in that field of view." "Oh, my, we're looking at Vega. That's a pretty near neighbor."
Her fingers were punching away at a keyboard as she talked.
"Look, it's only 26 light years away. It's been observed before, always with negative results. I looked at it myself in my first Arecibo survey. What's the absolute intensity? Oh, holy smoke, that's hundreds of Janskys. You could practically pick that up on your FM radio. Okay, so we have a bogey very near to Vega in the plane of the sky. It's at a frequency around 9.2 gigahertz. Not very monochromatic. The bandwidth is a few hundred hertz. It's linearly polarized, and it's transmitting a set of moving pulses restricted to two different amplitudes. In response to her typed commands, the screen now displayed the disposition of all the radio telescopes. It's being received by 116 individual telescopes. Well, clearly it's not a malfunction in one or two of them. Okay. Now, we should have plenty of time baseline. Is it moving with the stars? Or could it be some Elint satellite or aircraft? I can confirm sidereal motion, Dr. Arroway. Okay, that's pretty convincing. It's not down here on Earth, and it probably isn't from an artificial satellite in a Molniya orbit. Although we should check that. When you get a chance, Willie, call up NORAD and see what they say about the satellite possibility. If we can exclude satellites, that will leave two possibilities. It's a hoax, or somebody has finally gotten around to sending us a message. Steve, do a manual override. Check a few individual radio telescopes. The signal strength is certainly large enough, and see if there's any chance this is a hoax, you know, a practical joke by someone who wishes to teach us the error of our ways. A handful of other scientists and technicians, alerted on their buzzers by the Argus computer, had gathered around the command console. There were half smiles on their faces. None of them was thinking seriously of a message from another world quite yet. But there was a sense of no school today, a break in the tedious routine to which they had become accustomed, and perhaps a faint air of expectation. If any of you can think of any other explanation besides extraterrestrial intelligence, I want to hear about it, she said, acknowledging their presence. There's no way it could be Vega, Dr. Arroway. The system's only a few hundred million years old. Its planets are still in the process of forming. There isn't time for intelligent life to have developed there. It has to be some background star or galaxy.
But then the transmitter power has to be ridiculously large, responded a member of the Quasar group, who had returned to see what was happening. We need to get going right away on a sensitive proper motion study so we can see if the radio source moves with Vega.
Of course you're right about the proper motion, Jack, she said. But there's another possibility. Maybe they didn't grow up in the Vega system. Maybe they're just visiting. That's no good either. The system is full of debris. It's a failed solar system, or a solar system still in its early stages of development. If they stay very long, their spacecraft will be clobbered. So they only arrived recently. Or they vaporize incoming meteorites. Or they take evasive action if there's a piece of debris on a collision trajectory. Or they're not in the ring plane, but in polar orbit. So they minimize their encounters with the debris. Oh, there's a million possibilities. But you're absolutely right. We don't have to guess whether the source is in the Vega system. We can actually find out. How long will that proper motion study take? Oh, by the way, Steve, this isn't your shift. At least tell Consuela you're going to be late for dinner. Willie, who had been talking on the phone at an adjacent console, was displaying a wan smile. Well, I got through to a major brain tree at NORAD. He swears up and down they have nothing that'll give this signal, especially not at 9 gigahertz. Of course, they tell us that every time we call. Anyway, he says they haven't detected any spacecraft at the right ascension and declination of Vega. What about darks? By this time, there were many dark satellites with low radar cross-sections, designed to orbit the Earth unannounced and undetected until an hour of need. Then they would serve as backups for launch detection or communications in a nuclear war, in case the first-line military satellites dedicated to these purposes were suddenly missing in action. Occasionally, a dark would be detected by one of the major astronomical radar systems. All nations would deny that the object belonged to them, and breathless speculation would erupt that an extraterrestrial spacecraft had been detected in Earth orbit. As the millennium approached, the UFO cults were thriving again. Interferometry now rules out ammonia-type orbit, Dr. Arroway.
Well,
better and better.
Now, let's take a closer look at those moving pulses. Assuming that this is binary arithmetic, has anybody converted it into base 10? Do we know what the sequence of numbers is? Okay, here, we can do it in our heads. 59, 61, 67, 71. Aren't these all prime numbers? A little buzz of excitement circulated through the control room. Ellie's own face momentarily revealed a flutter of something deeply felt. But this was quickly replaced by a sobriety, a fear of being carried away, an apprehension about appearing foolish, unscientific. Okay, let's see if I can do another quick summary. I'll do it in the simplest language. Please check if I've missed anything. We have an extremely strong, not very monochromatic signal. Immediately outside the bandpass of this signal, there are no other frequencies reporting anything besides noise. The signal is linearly polarized, as if it's being broadcast by a radio telescope. The signal is around 9 gigahertz, near the minimum in the galactic radio noise background. It's the right kind of frequency for anyone who wants to be heard over a big distance. We've confirmed sidereal motion of the source, so it's moving as if it's up there among the stars, and not from some local transmitter. NORAD tells us they don't detect any satellites, ours or anybody else's, that match the position of this source. Interferometry excludes a source in Earth orbit anyway. Steve has now looked at the data outside the automated mode, and it doesn't seem to be a program that somebody with a warped sense of humor put into the computer. The region of the sky we're looking at includes Vega, which is an A0 main sequence dwarf star. It's not exactly like the sun, but it's only 26 light years away, and it has the prototype stellar debris ring. There are no known planets, but there certainly could be planets we don't know anything about around Vega. We're setting up a proper motion study to see if the source is well behind our line of sight to Vega, and we should have an answer in a few weeks if we're restricted on our own, a few hours if we do some long baseline interferometry. Finally, what's being sent seems to be a long sequence of prime numbers. Integers that can't be divided by any other number except themselves and one. No astrophysical process is likely to generate prime numbers. So I'd say we want to be cautious, of course, but I'd say that by every criterion we can lay our hands on, this looks like the real thing. But there's a problem with the idea that this is a message from guys who evolved on some planet around Vega, because they would have had to evolve very fast. The entire lifetime of the star is only about 400 million years. It's an unlikely place for the nearest civilization, so the proper motion study is very important. But I sure would like to check out that hoax possibility some more. "Look," said one of the quasar survey astronomers who had been hovering in the back. He inclined his jaw to the western horizon, where a faint pink aura showed unmistakably where the sun had set. "Vega's going to set in another couple of hours. It's probably already risen in Australia. Can't we call Sydney and get them looking at the same time that we're still seeing it?" "Good idea. It's only middle afternoon there. And together we'll have enough baseline for the proper motion study. Give me that summary printout, and I'll telefax it to Australia from my office." With deliberate composure, Ellie left the assembled group crowded around the consoles and returned to her office. She closed the door very carefully behind her. "Holy shit," she whispered. "Ian Broderick, please. Yes, this is Eleanor Arroway at Project Argus. It's something of an emergency. Thanks, I'll hold on. Hello, Ian. It's probably nothing, but we have a bogey here and wonder if you could just check it out for us. It's around 9 gigahertz with a few hundred hertz bandpass. I'm telefaxing the parameters now. You have a feed good at 9 gigahertz already on the dish? That's a bit of luck. Yes, Vega is smack in the middle of the field of view. And we're getting what looks like prime number pulses." "Really? Okay, I'll hold on." She considered again how backward the world astronomical community still was. A joint computer databasing system was still not online. Its value for asynchronous telenetting alone would
Listen, Ian, while the telescope finishes slewing, could you set up to look at an amplitude time plot? Let's call the low-amplitude pulses dots and the high-amplitude pulses dashes. We're getting, yes, that's just the pattern we've been seeing for the last half hour.
Maybe.
Well, it's the best candidate in 5 years. But I keep remembering how badly the Soviets got fooled with that Big Bird satellite incident around, 74. Well, the way I understand it, it was a U.S. radar altimetry survey of the Soviet Union for cruise missile guidance. Yes, a terrain mapper. And the Soviets were picking it up on omnidirectional antennas. They couldn't tell where in the sky the signal was coming from. All they knew was they were getting the same sequence of pulses from the sky at about the same time every morning. Their people assured them it wasn't a military transmission, so naturally they thought it was extraterrestrial. No, we've excluded a satellite transmission already. Oh, Ian, could we trouble you to follow it for as long as it's in your sky? I'll talk to you about VLBI later. I'm going to see if I can't get other radio observatories distributed pretty evenly in longitude to follow it until it reappears back here. Yes, but I don't know if it's easy to make a direct phone call to China. I'm thinking of sending an IAU telegram. Fine. Now, many thanks, Ian.
Ellie paused in the doorway of the control room. They called it that with conscious irony, because it was the computers in another room that by and large did the controlling. To admire the small group of scientists who were talking with great animation, scrutinizing the data being displayed, and engaging in mild badinage on the nature of the signal. These were not stylish people, she thought. They were not conventionally good-looking. But there was something unmistakably attractive about them. They were excellent at what they did, and especially in the discovery process, were utterly absorbed in their work. As she approached, they fell silent and looked at her expectantly. The numerals were now being converted automatically from base 2 to base 10. 881, 883, 887, 907. Each one confirmed as a prime number.
Willie, get me a world map. And please get me Mark Auerbach in Cambridge, Mass. He'll probably be at home. Give him this message for an IAU telegram to all observatories, but especially to all large radio observatories. And see if he'll check our telephone number for the Beijing Radio Observatory.
Then get me the president's science advisor.
You're going to bypass the National Science Foundation?
After Auerbach, get me the president's science advisor.
In her mind, she thought she could hear one joyous shout amidst a clamor of other voices. By bicycle, small truck, perambulatory mailman, or telephone, the single paragraph was delivered to astronomical centers all over the world. In a few major radio observatories, in China, India, the Soviet Union, and Holland, for example, the message was delivered by teletype. As it chattered in, it was scanned by a security officer or some passing astronomer, torn off, and with a look of some curiosity, carried into an adjacent office. It read, "Anomalous intermittent radio source at right ascension, 18 hours 34 minutes. Declination plus 38 degrees 41 minutes. Discovered by Argus Systematic Sky Survey. Frequency 9.2417684 gigahertz. Band pass approximately 430 hertz. Bimodal amplitudes approximately 174 and 179 Janskis. Evidence amplitudes and code sequence of prime numbers. Full longitude coverage urgently needed. Please call Collect for further information and coordinating observations. E. Arroway, Director, Project Argus, Socorro, New Mexico, USA. Chapter 5. Decryption Algorithm. Oh, speak again, bright angel. William Shakespeare. Romeo and Juliet. The visiting scientists' quarters were now all occupied, indeed overcrowded, by selected luminaries of the SETI community. When the official delegations began arriving from Washington, they found no suitable accommodations at the Argus site and had to be billeted at motels in nearby Socorro. K.
Kenneth Terhier, the president's science advisor, was the only exception. He had arrived the day after the discovery, in response to an urgent call from Eleanor Arroway. Officials from the National Science Foundation, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, the Department of Defense, the President's Science Advisory Committee, the National Security Council, and the National Security Agency trickled in during the next few days. There were a few government employees whose precise institutional affiliations remained obscure. The previous evening, some of them stood at the base of Telescope 101 and had Vega pointed out to them for the first time. Obligingly, its blue-white light flickered prettily.
"I mean, I've seen it before, but I never knew what it was called," one of them remarked.
Vega appeared brighter than the other stars in the sky, but in no other way noteworthy. It was merely one of the few thousand naked-eye stars. The scientists were running a continuous research seminar on the nature, origin, and possible significance of the radio pulses. The project's public affairs office, larger than in most observatories because of widespread interest in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, was assigned the task of filling in the lower-ranking officials. Every new arrival required an extensive personal briefing. Ellie, who was obliged to brief the senior officials, supervise the ongoing research, and respond to the entirely proper skeptical scrutiny being offered with some vigor by her colleagues, was exhausted. The luxury of a full night's sleep had eluded her since the discovery. At first, they had tried to keep the finding quiet. After all, they were not absolutely sure it was an extraterrestrial message. A premature or mistaken announcement would be a public relations disaster. But worse than that, it would interfere with the data analysis. If the press descended, the science would surely suffer. Washington, as well as Argus, was keen to keep the story quiet. But the scientists had told their families. The International Astronomical Union telegram had been sent all over the world. And still rudimentary astronomical databasing systems in Europe, North America, and Japan were all carrying news of the discovery. Although there had been a range of contingency plans for the public release of any findings, the actual circumstances had caught them largely unprepared. They drafted as innocuous a statement as they could and released it only when they had to. It caused, of course, a sensation. They had asked the media's forbearance, but knew there would be only a brief period before the press would descend in force. They had tried to discourage reporters from visiting the site, explaining that there was no real information in the signals they were receiving, just tedious and repetitive prime numbers. The press was impatient with the absence of hard news. "You can only do so many sidebars on what is a prime number," one reporter explained to Ellie over the telephone. Television camera crews in fixed-wing air taxis and chartered helicopters began making low passes over the facility, sometimes generating strong radio interference, easily detected by the telescopes. Some reporters stalked the officials from Washington when they returned to their motels at night. A few of the more enterprising had attempted to enter the facility unobserved, by beach buggy, motorcycle, and in one case on horseback. She had been forced to inquire about bulk rates on cyclone fencing. Immediately after Terhier arrived, he had received an early version of what was by now Ellie's standard briefing. The surprising intensity of the signal, its location in very much the same part of the sky as the star Vega, the nature of the pulses.
"I may be the president's science advisor," he had said, "but I'm only a biologist. So please explain it to me slowly. I understand that if the radio source is 26 light years away, then the message had to be sent 26 years ago. In the 1960s, some funny-looking people with pointy ears thought we'd want to know that they like prime numbers. But prime numbers aren't difficult. It's not like they're boasting. It's more like they're sending us remedial arithmetic. Maybe we should be insulted."
"No, look at it this way," she said, smiling. "This is a beacon. It's an announcement signal. It's designed to attract our attention.
We get strange patterns of pulses from quasars and pulsars and radio galaxies and God knows what. But prime numbers are very specific, very artificial. No even number is prime, for example. It's hard to imagine some radiating plasma or exploding galaxy sending out a regular set of mathematical signals like this. The prime numbers are to attract our attention. But what for? He had asked, genuinely baffled. I don't know. But in this business, you have to be very patient. Maybe in a while, the prime numbers will turn off and be replaced by something else. Something very rich. The real message. We just have to keep on listening. This was the hardest part to explain to the press. That the signals had essentially no content. No meaning. Just the first few hundred prime numbers in order. A cycling back to the beginning. And again, the simple binary arithmetic representations. 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19, 23, 29, 31. 9 wasn't a prime number, she explained, because it was divisible by 3, as well as 9 and 1, of course. 10 wasn't a prime number because 5 and 2 went into it, as well as 10 and 1. 11 was a prime number because it was divisible only by 1 and itself. But why transmit prime numbers? It reminded her of an idiot savant, one of those people who might be grossly deficient in ordinary social or verbal skills, but who could perform mind-boggling feats of mental arithmetic, such as figuring out after a moment's thought on what day of the week June 1st in the year 11,977 will fall. It wasn't for anything. They did it because they liked doing it, because they were able to do it. She knew it was only a few days after receipt of the message. But she was at once exhilarated and deeply disappointed. After all these years, they had finally received a signal. Sort of. But its content was shallow, hollow, empty. She had imagined receiving the Encyclopedia Galactica. We've only achieved the capacity for radio astronomy in the last few decades, she reminded herself, in a galaxy where the average star is billions of years old. The chance of receiving a signal from a civilization exactly as advanced as we are should be minuscule. If they were even a little behind us, they would lack the technological capability to communicate with us at all. So the most likely signal would come from a civilization much more advanced. Maybe they would be able to write full and melodic mirror fugues. The counterpoint would be the theme written backwards. No, she decided. While this was a kind of genius without a doubt, and certainly beyond her ability, it was a tiny extrapolation from what human beings could do. Bach and Mozart had made at least respectable stabs at it. She tried to make a bigger leap into the mind of someone who was enormously, orders of magnitude more intelligent than she was, smarter than Drumlin, say, or Ada, the young Nigerian physicist who had just won the Nobel Prize. But it was impossible. She could muse about demonstrating Fermat's last theorem or the Goldbach conjecture in only a few lines of equations. She could imagine problems enormously beyond us that would be old hat to them. But she couldn't get into their minds. She couldn't imagine what thinking would be like if you were much more capable than a human being. Of course. No surprise. What did she expect? It was like trying to visualize a new primary color, or a world in which you could recognize several hundred acquaintances individually only by their smells. She could talk about this, but she couldn't experience it. By definition, it has to be mighty hard to understand the behavior of a being much smarter than you are. But even so, why only prime numbers? The Argus radio astronomers had made progress in the last few days. Vega had a known motion, a known component of its velocity toward or away from the Earth, and a known component laterally across the sky, against the background of more distant stars. The Argus telescopes, working together with radio observatories in West Virginia and Australia, had determined that the source was moving with Vega. Not only was the signal coming, as carefully as they could measure from where Vega was in the sky, but the signal also shared the peculiar and characteristic motions of Vega.
Unless this was a hoax of heroic proportions, the source of the prime number pulses was indeed in the Vega system. There was no additional Doppler effect due to the motion of the transmitter, perhaps tied to a planet about Vega. The extraterrestrials had compensated for the orbital motion. Perhaps it was a kind of interstellar courtesy.
It's the goddamnest most wonderful thing I ever heard of. And it's got nothing to do with our shop,
said an official of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, preparing to return to Washington. As soon as the discovery had been made, Ellie had assigned a handful of the telescopes to examine Vega in a range of other frequencies. Sure enough, they had found the same signal, the same monotonous succession of prime numbers beeping away in the 1420 megahertz hydrogen line, the 1667 megahertz hydroxyl line, and at many other frequencies. All over the radio spectrum, with an electromagnetic orchestra, Vega was bleeding out prime numbers.
Doesn't make sense, said Drumlin, casually touching his belt buckle. We couldn't have missed it before. Everybody's looked at Vega for years. Arroway observed it from Arecibo a decade ago. Suddenly, last Tuesday, Vega starts broadcasting prime numbers? Why now? What's so special about now? How come they start transmitting just a few years after Argus starts listening?
Maybe their transmitter was down for repairs for a couple of centuries, Valerian suggested, and they just got it back online. Maybe their duty cycle is to broadcast to us just 1 year out of every million. There are all those other candidate planets that might have life on them, you know. We're probably not the only kid on the block. But Drumlin, plainly dissatisfied, only shook his head. Although his nature was the opposite of conspiratorial, Valerian thought he had caught an undercurrent in Drumlin's last question. Could all this be a reckless, desperate attempt by Argus scientists to prevent a premature closing down of the project? It wasn't possible. Valerian shook his head. As Drahir walked by, he found himself confronted by two senior experts on the SETI problem, silently shaking their heads at one another. Between the scientists and the bureaucrats, there was a kind of unease, a mutual discomfort, a clash of fundamental assumptions. One of the electrical engineers called it an impedance mismatch. The scientists were too speculative, too quantitative, and too casual about talking to anybody for the tastes of many of the bureaucrats. The bureaucrats were too unimaginative, too qualitative, too uncommunicative for many of the scientists. Ellie and especially Drahir tried hard to bridge the gap, but the pontoons kept being swept downstream. This night, cigarette butts and coffee cups were everywhere. The casually dressed scientists, Washington officials in lightweight suits, and an occasional flag-rank military officer filled the control room, the seminar room, the small auditorium, and spilled out of doors, where, illuminated by cigarettes and starlight, some of the discussions continued. But tempers were frayed. The strain was showing.
Dr. Arroway, this is Michael Kitts, Assistant Secretary of Defense for C-Cubed I.
Introducing Kitts and positioning himself just a step behind him, Drahir was communicating, what? Some unlikely mix of emotions. Bemusement in the arms of prudence? He seemed to be appealing for restraint. Did he think her such a hothead? C-Cubed I, pronounced C-Cubed I, stood for Command, Control, Communications, and Intelligence. Important responsibilities at a time when the United States and the Soviet Union were gamely making major phased reductions in their strategic nuclear arsenals. It was a job for a cautious man. Kitts settled himself in one of the two chairs across the desk from Ellie, leaned forward and read the Kafka quote. He was unimpressed.
Dr. Arroway, let me come right to the point. We're concerned about whether it's in the best interest of the United States for this information to be generally known. We were not overjoyed about your sending that telegram all over the world.
You mean to China? To Russia?
To India? Her voice, despite her best effort, had a discernible edge to it. You wanted to keep the first 261 prime numbers secret? Do you suppose, Mr. Kitts, the extraterrestrials intended to communicate only with Americans? Don't you think that a message from another civilization belongs to the whole world?
You might have asked our advice.
And risk losing the signal? Look, for all we know, something essential, something unique might have been broadcast after Vega had set here in New Mexico, but when it was high in the sky over Beijing. These signals aren't exactly a person-to-person call to the U.S. of A. They're not even a person-to-person call to the Earth. It's station-to-station to any planet in the solar system. We just happened to be lucky enough to pick up the phone. Jurhir was radiating something again. What was he trying to tell her? That he liked that elementary analogy, but ease up on kids? In any case, she continued, it's too late. Everybody knows now that there's some kind of intelligent life in the Vega system.
I'm not sure it's too late, Dr. Arroway. You seem to think there'll be some information-rich transmission, a message still to come. Dr. Jurhir here...
He paused to listen to the unexpected assonance.
Dr. Jurhir says you think these prime numbers are an announcement, something to make us pay attention. If there is a message, and it's subtle, something those other countries wouldn't pick up right away, I want it kept quiet until we can talk about it.
Many of us have wants, Mr. Kitts, she found herself saying sweetly, ignoring Jurhir's raised eyebrows. There was something irritating, almost provocative about Kitts's manner, and probably hers as well. I, for example, have a want to understand what the meaning of this signal is, and what's happening on Vega, and what it means for the Earth. It's possible that scientists in other nations are the key to that understanding. Maybe we'll need their data. Maybe we'll need their brains. I could imagine this might be a problem too big for one country to handle all by itself. Jurhir now appeared faintly alarmed.
Dr. Arroway, Secretary Kitts' suggestion isn't all that unreasonable. It's very possible we'd bring other nations in. All he's asking is to talk about it with us first. And that's only if there's a new message.
His tone was calming but not unctuous. She looked at him closely again. Jurhir was not a patently handsome man, but he had a kind and intelligent face. He was wearing a blue suit and a crisp Oxford shirt. His seriousness and air of self-possession were moderated by the warmth of his smile. Why, then, was he shilling for this jerk? Part of his job? Could it be that Kitts was talking sense?
It's a remote contingency, anyway, Kitts sighed as he got to his feet. The Secretary of Defense would appreciate your cooperation.
He was trying to be winning.
Agreed?
Let me think about it, she replied, taking his proffered hand as if it were a dead fish.
I'll be along in a few minutes, Mike, Jurhir said cheerfully.
His hand on the lintel of the door, Kitts had an apparent afterthought, removed a document from his inside breast pocket, returned and placed it gingerly on the corner of her desk.
Oh, yes, I forgot. Here's a copy of the Haddon decision. You probably know it. It's about the government's right to classify material vital to the security of the United States, even if it didn't originate in a classified facility.
You want to classify the prime numbers? She asked, her eyes wide in mock incredulity.
See you outside, Ken.
She began talking the moment Kitts left her office.
What's he after? Vegan death rays? World blower uppers? What's this really about?
He's just being prudent, Ellie. I can see you don't think that's the whole story.
Okay.
Suppose there's some message, you know, with real content, and in it there's something offensive to Muslims, say, or to Methodists. Shouldn't we release it carefully so the United States doesn't get a black eye?
Oh, Ken, don't bullshit me.
That man is an assistant secretary of defense. If they're worried about Muslims and Methodists, they would have sent me an assistant secretary of state, or, I don't know, one of those religious fanatics who preside at presidential prayer breakfasts.
You're the president's science advisor. What did you advise her?
I haven't advised her anything. Since I've been here, I've only talked to her once, briefly on the phone. And I'll be frank with you, she didn't give me any instructions about classification. I thought what Kit said was way off base. I think he's acting on his own.
Who is he?
As far as I know, he's a lawyer. He was a top executive in the electronics industry before joining the administration. He really knows C-cubed I, but that doesn't make him knowledgeable about anything else.
Ken, I trust you. I believe you didn't set me up for this Haddon decision threat.
She waved the document in front of her and paused, seeking his eyes.
Do you know that Drumlin thinks there's another message in the polarization?
I don't understand.
Just a few hours ago, Dave finished a rough statistical study of the polarization. He's represented the Stokes parameters by Poincaré spheres. There's a nice movie of them varying in time.
Jurhir looked at her blankly.
Don't biologists use polarized light in their microscopes? She asked herself.
When a wave of light comes at you, visible light, radio light, any kind of light, it's vibrating at right angles to your line of sight. If that vibration rotates, the wave is said to be elliptically polarized. If it rotates clockwise, the polarization is called right-handed. Counterclockwise, it's left-handed. I know it's a dumb designation. Anyway, by varying between the two kinds of polarization, you could transmit information. A little right polarization, and that's zero. A little left, and it's a one. Follow? It's perfectly possible. We have amplitude modulation and frequency modulation. But our civilization, by convention, ordinarily just doesn't do polarization modulation.
Well, the Vega signal looks as if it has polarization modulation. We're busy checking it out right now. But Dave found that there wasn't an equal amount of the two sorts of polarization. It wasn't left polarized as much as it was right polarized. It's just possible that there's another message in the polarization that we've missed so far. That's why I'm suspicious about your friend. Kitz isn't just giving me general, gratuitous advice. He knows we may be onto something else.
Ellie, take it easy. You've hardly slept for 4 days. You've been juggling the science, the administration, and the press. You've already made one of the major discoveries of the century, and if I understand you right, you might be on the verge of something even more important. You've got every right to be a little on edge. And threatening to militarize the project was clumsy of Kitz. I don't have any trouble understanding why you're suspicious of him. But there's some sense to what he says.
Do you know the man?
Been in a few meetings with him. I can hardly say I know him.
Ellie, if there's a possibility of a real message coming in, wouldn't it be a good idea to thin out the crowd a little?
Sure. Give me a hand with some of the Washington deadwood.
Okay.
And if you leave that document on your desk, someone will be in here and draw the wrong conclusion. Why don't you put it away somewhere?
You're going to help?
If the situation stays anything like what it is now, I'll help. We're not going to make our best effort if this thing gets classified.
Smiling, Ellie knelt before her small office safe and punched in the 6-digit combination, 314159. She took one last glance at the document that was titled in large black letters, The United States versus Haddon Cybernetics, and locked it away. It was a group of about 30 people, technicians and scientists associated with Project Argus, a few senior government officials, including the deputy director of the Defense Intelligence Agency in civilian clothes. Among them were Valerian, Drumlin, Kitz, and Jurhir. Ellie was the only woman. They had set up a large television projection system, focused on a 2-meter by 2-meter screen set flush against the far wall.
Ellie was simultaneously addressing the group and the decryption program,
her fingers on the keyboard before her.
Over the years, we've prepared for the computer decryption of many kinds of possible messages. We've just learned from Dr. Drumlin's analysis that there's information in the polarization modulation. All that frenetic switching between left and right means something. It's not random noise. It's as if you're flipping a coin. Of course, you expect as many heads as tails. But instead,
you get twice as many heads as tails. So you conclude that the coin is loaded, or in our case, that the polarization modulation isn't random. It has content. Look at this. What the computer has just now told us is even more interesting. The precise sequence of heads and tails repeats. It's a long sequence, so it's a pretty complex message, and the transmitting civilization must want us to be sure to get it right. Here, you see? This is the repeating message. We're now into the first repetition. Every bit of information, every dot and dash, if you want to think of them that way, is identical to what it was in the last block of data. Now we analyze the total number of bits. It's a number in the tens of billions. Okay, bingo, it's the product of three prime numbers. Although Drumlin and Valerian were both beaming, it seemed to Ellie they were experiencing quite different emotions.
So what? What do some more prime numbers mean?
A visitor from Washington asked. It means, maybe, that we're being sent a picture. You see, this message is made up of a large number of bits of information. Suppose that large number is the product of three smaller numbers. It's a number times a number times a number. So there's three dimensions to the message. I'd guess either it's a single static three-dimensional picture, like a stationary hologram, or it's a two-dimensional picture that changes with time, a movie. Let's assume it's a movie. If it's a hologram, it'll take us longer to display anyway. We've got an ideal decryption algorithm for this one. On the screen, they made out an indistinct moving pattern composed of perfect whites and perfect blacks. Willie, put in some gray interpolation program, would you? Anything reasonable? And try rotating it about 90 degrees counterclockwise. Dr. Arroway, there seems to be an auxiliary sideband channel. Maybe it's the audio to go with the movie. Punch it up. The only other practical application of prime numbers she could think of was public key cryptography, now widely used in commercial and national security contexts. One application was to make a message clear to dummies. The other was to keep a message hidden from the tolerably intelligent. End of side four.
Side 5.
Ellie scanned the faces before her. Kitz looked uncomfortable. Perhaps he was anticipating some alien invader, or worse, the design drawings of a weapon too secret for her staff to be trusted with. Willie looked very earnest and was swallowing over and over again. A picture is different from mere numbers. The possibility of a visual message was clearly rousing unexamined fears and fantasies in the hearts of many of the onlookers. Jurhir had a wonderful expression on his face. For the moment, he seemed much less the official, the bureaucrat, the presidential advisor, and much more the scientist. The picture, still unintelligible, was joined by a deep rumbling glissando of sounds, sliding first up and then down the audio spectrum, until it gravitated to rest somewhere around the octave below middle C. Slowly the group became aware of faint but swelling music. The picture rotated, rectified, and focused. Ellie found herself staring at a black and white grainy image of a massive reviewing stand adorned with an immense Art Deco eagle. Clutched in the eagle's concrete talons.
Hoax! It's a hoax!
There were cries of astonishment, incredulity, laughter, mild hysteria.
Oh, don't you see you've been hoodwinked?
Drumlin was saying to her almost conversationally. He was smiling.
It's an elaborate practical joke.
Oh, you've been wasting the time of everybody here.
Clutched in the eagle's concrete talons, she could now see clearly, was a swastika. The camera zoomed in above the eagle to find the smiling face of Adolf Hitler, waving to a rhythmically chanting crowd. His uniform, devoid of military decorations, conveyed a modest simplicity.
The deep, baritone voice of an announcer, scratchy but unmistakably speaking German, filled the room. Gerhier moved toward her.
"Do you know German?"
she whispered.
"What's it saying?"
"The Führer," he translated slowly, "welcomes the world to the German fatherland for the opening of the 1936 Olympic Games." Chapter 6 Palimpsest. And if the guardians are not happy, who else can be? Aristotle, The Politics, Book 2, Chapter 5. As the plane reached cruising altitude, with Albuquerque already more than 100 miles behind them, Ellie idly glanced at the small white cardboard rectangle imprinted with blue letters that had been stapled to her airline ticket envelope. It read, in language unchanged since her first commercial flight, "This is not the luggage ticket, baggage check, described by Article 4 of the Warsaw Convention." Why were the airlines so worried, she wondered, that passengers might mistake this piece of cardboard for the Warsaw Convention ticket? For that matter, what was a Warsaw Convention ticket? Why had she never seen one? Where were they storing them? In some forgotten key event in the history of aviation, an inattentive airline must have forgotten to print this caveat on cardboard rectangles and was sued into bankruptcy by irate passengers laboring under the misapprehension that this was the Warsaw luggage ticket. Doubtless there were sound financial reasons for this worldwide concern, never otherwise articulated, about which pieces of cardboard are not described by the Warsaw Convention. Imagine, she thought, all those cumulative lines of type devoted instead to something useful, the history of world exploration, say, or incidental facts of science, or even the average number of passenger miles until your airplane crashed. If she had accepted Gerhier's offer of a military airplane, she would be having other casual associations. But that would have been far too cozy, perhaps some aperture leading to an eventual militarization of the project. They had preferred to travel by commercial carrier. Valerian's eyes were already closed as he finished settling into the seat beside her. There had been no particular hurry, even after taking care of those last-minute details on the data analysis, with the hint that the second layer of the onion was about to unpeel. They had been able to make a commercial flight that would arrive in Washington well before tomorrow's meeting. In fact, in plenty of time for a good night's sleep. She glanced at the telefax system, neatly zipped into a leather carrying case under the seat in front of her. It was several hundred kilobits per second faster than Peter's old model, and displayed much better graphics. Well, maybe tomorrow she would have to use it to explain to the President of the United States what Adolf Hitler was doing on Vega. She was, she admitted to herself, a little nervous about the meeting. She had never met a president before. And by late 20th century standards, this one wasn't half bad. She hadn't had time to get her hair done, much less a facial. Oh, well, she wasn't going to the White House to be looked at. What would her stepfather think? Did he still believe she was unsuited for science? Or her mother, now confined to a wheelchair in a nursing home? She had managed only one brief phone call to her mother since the discovery over a week ago, and promised herself to call again tomorrow. As she had done 100 times before, she peered out the airplane window and imagined what impression the Earth would make on an extraterrestrial observer at this cruising altitude of 12 or 14 kilometers, and assuming the alien had eyes something like ours. There were vast areas of the Midwest, intricately geometrized with squares, rectangles, and circles by those with agricultural or urban predilections. And, as here, vast areas of the Southwest, in which the only sign of intelligent life was an occasional straight line heading between mountains and across deserts. Are the worlds of more advanced civilizations totally geometrized, entirely rebuilt by their inhabitants? Or would the signature of a really advanced civilization be that they left no sign at all? Would they be able to tell in one swift glance precisely which stage we were in some great cosmic evolutionary sequence in the development of intelligent beings. What else could they tell? From the blueness of the sky, they could make a rough estimate of Loschmidt's number, how many molecules there were in a cubic centimeter at sea level, about 3 × 10⁻¹. They could easily tell the altitudes of the clouds from the length of their shadows on the ground. If they knew that the clouds were condensed water, they could roughly calculate the temperature lapse rate of the atmosphere, because the temperature had to fall to about -40°C at the altitude of the highest clouds she could see. The erosion of landforms, the dendritic patterns and oxbows of rivers, the presence of lakes and battered volcanic plugs, all spoke of an ancient battle between landforming and erosional processes. Really, you could see at a glance that this was an antique planet with a brand new civilization. Most of the planets in the galaxy would be venerable and pre-technical, maybe even lifeless. A few would harbor civilizations much older than ours. Worlds with technical civilizations just beginning to emerge must be spectacularly rare. It was perhaps the only quality fundamentally unique about the Earth. Through lunch, the landscape slowly turned verdant as they approached the Mississippi Valley. There was hardly any sense of motion in modern air travel, Ellie thought. She looked at Peter's still sleeping form. He had rejected with some indignation the prospect of an airline lunch. Beyond him, across the aisle, was a very young human being, perhaps 3 months old, comfortably nestled in its father's arms. What was an infant's view of air travel? You go to a special place, walk into a large room with seats in it, and sit down. The room rumbles and shakes for 4 hours. Then you get up and walk off. Magically, you're somewhere else. The means of transportation seems obscure to you, but the basic idea is easy to grasp, and precocious mastery of the Navier-Stokes equations is not required. It was late afternoon when they circled Washington, awaiting permission to land. She could make out, between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial, a vast crowd of people. It was, she had read only an hour earlier in the Times Telefax, a massive rally of black Americans protesting economic disparities and educational inequities. Considering the justice of their grievances, she thought, they had been very patient. She wondered how the president would respond to the rally and to the Vega transmission, on both of which some official public comment would have to be made tomorrow. "What do you mean, Ken? They get out?" "I mean, Ms. President, that our television signals leave this planet and go out into space." "Well, just exactly how far do they go?" "With all due respect, Ms. President, it doesn't work that way." "Well, how does it work?" "The signals spread out from the Earth in spherical waves, a little like ripples in a pond. They travel at the speed of light, 186,000 miles a second, and essentially go on forever. The better some other civilization's receivers are, the farther away they could be and still pick up our TV signals. Even we could detect a strong TV transmission from a planet going around the nearest star." For a moment, the president stood ramrod straight, staring out the French doors into the Rose Garden. She turned toward Derheer.
"You mean everything?"
"Oh, yes, everything."
"You mean to say all that crap on television? The car crashes, wrestling, the porno channels, the evening news?"
"Everything, Miss President." Derheer shook his head in sympathetic consternation.
"Derheer, do I understand you correctly? Does this mean that all my press conferences, my debates, my inaugural address are out there?" "Oh, that's the good news, Miss President. The bad news is, so are all the television appearances of your predecessor, and Dick Nixon, and the Soviet leadership. And so are a lot of nasty things your opponents said about you. It's a mixed blessing."
"My God. Okay, go on." The president had turned away from the French doors and was now apparently preoccupied in examining a marble bust of Tom Paine, newly restored from the basement of the Smithsonian Institution, where it had been consigned by the previous incumbent.
Look at it this way. Those few minutes of television from Vega were originally broadcast in 1936 at the opening of the Olympic Games in Berlin. Even though it was only shown in Germany, it was the first television transmission on Earth with even moderate power. Unlike the ordinary radio transmission in the 30s, those TV signals got through our ionosphere and trickled out into space. We're trying to find out exactly what was transmitted back then, but, man, it'll probably take some time. Maybe that welcome from Hitler is the only fragment of the transmission they were able to pick up on Vega. So, from their point of view, Hitler is the first sign of intelligent life on Earth. I'm not trying to be ironic. They don't know what the transmission means, so they record it and transmit it back to us. It's a way of saying, hello, we heard you. It seems to me a pretty friendly gesture. Then you say there wasn't any television broadcasting until after the Second World War? Well, nothing to speak of. There was a local broadcast in England on the coronation of George VI. A few things like that. Big-time television transmission began in the late 40s. All those programs are leaving the Earth at the speed of light. Imagine the Earth is here. Terhir gestured in the air. And there's a little spherical wave running away from it at the speed of light, starting out in 1936. It keeps expanding and receding from the Earth. Sooner or later, it reaches the nearest civilization. They seem to be surprisingly close, only 26 light-years away on some planet of the star Vega. They record it and play it back to us. But it takes another 26 years for the Berlin Olympics to return to Earth. So the Vegans didn't take decades to figure it out. They must have been pretty much tuned, all set up, ready to go, waiting for our first television signals. They detect them, record them, and after a while play them back to us. But unless they've already been here, you know, some survey mission 100 years ago, they couldn't have known we were about to invent television. So Dr. Arroway thinks this civilization is monitoring all the nearby planetary systems to see if any of its neighbors develop high technology. Ken, there's a lot of things here to think about. Are you sure those, what do you call them, Vegans, you sure they don't understand what that television program was about? Ms. President, there's no doubt they're smart. That was a very weak signal in 1936. Their detectors have to be fantastically sensitive to pick it up. But I don't see how they could possibly understand what it means. They probably look very different from us. They must have different history, different customs. There's no way for them to know what a swastika is or who Adolf Hitler was. Adolf Hitler. Ken, it makes me furious. 40 million people die to defeat that megalomaniac, and he's the star of the first broadcast to another civilization. He's representing us. And them. It's that madman's wildest dream come true. She paused and continued in a calmer voice. You know, I never thought Hitler could manage that Hitler salute. He never gave it straight on. It was always skewed at some wacko angle. And then there was that fruity bent elbow salute. If anyone else had done his Heil Hitler so incompetently, he would have been sent to the Russian front. But isn't there a difference? He was only returning the salutes of others. He wasn't heiling Hitler. Oh, yes, he was, returned the president. And with a gesture, ushered Dürer out of the rose room and down a corridor. Suddenly she stopped and regarded her science advisor. What if the Nazis didn't have television in 1936? Then what would have happened? Well, then I suppose it would be the coronation of George VI, or one of the transmissions about the New York World's Fair in 1939, if any of them were strong enough to be received on Vega. Or some programs from the late 40s, early 50s. You know, Howdy Doody, Milton Berle, the Army-McCarthy hearings? All those marvelous signs of intelligent life on Earth. Oh, those goddamn programs are our ambassadors into space, the emissary from Earth. She paused a moment to savor the phrase. An ambassador? You're supposed to put your best foot forward. And we've been sending mainly crap to space for 40 years. I'd like to see the network executives come to grips with this one. And that madman Hitler. That's the first news they have about Earth? Oh, what are they going to think of us? As Dürer and the president entered the cabinet room, those who had been standing in small groups fell silent, and some who had been seated made efforts to stand.
With a perfunctory gesture, the president conveyed a preference for informality and casually greeted the Secretary of State and an assistant Secretary of Defense. With a slow and deliberate turn of the head, she scanned the group. Some returned her gaze expectantly. Others, detecting an expression of minor annoyance on the president's face, averted their eyes.
"Ken, isn't that astronomer of yours here, Arrowsmith, Arrowroot?"
Arrowway, Miss President. She and Dr. Valerian arrived last night. Maybe they've been held up in traffic.
"Dr. Arrowway called from her hotel, Miss President," volunteered a meticulously groomed young man. "She said there was some new data coming through on her telefax, and she wanted to bring it to this meeting. We're supposed to start without her."
Michael Kitts leaned forward, his tone and expression incredulous. "They're transmitting new data on this subject over an open telephone, insecure, in a Washington hotel room?" Jurhir responded so softly that Kitts had to lean still further forward to hear. "Micah, I think there's at least commercial encryption on her telefax. But remember, there are no security guidelines established in this matter. I'm sure that Dr. Arroway will be cooperative if guidelines are established."
"All right, let's begin," said the president. "This is a joint informal meeting of the National Security Council, and what for the time being we're calling the Special Contingency Task Group. I want to impress on all of you that nothing said in this room, I mean nothing, is to be discussed with anyone who isn't here, except for the Secretary of Defense and the Vice President, who are overseas. Yesterday, Dr. Jahir gave most of you a briefing on this unbelievable TV program from the Star Vega. It's the view of Dr. Jahir and others," she looked around the table, "that it's just a fluke that the first television program to get to Vega starred Adolf Hitler. But it's an embarrassment. I've asked the Director of Central Intelligence to prepare an assessment of any national security implications in all of this. Is there any direct threat from whoever the hell is sending this? Are we going to be in trouble if there's some new message and some other country decodes it first? But first, let me ask, Marvin, does this have anything to do with flying saucers?"
The Director of Central Intelligence, an authoritative man in late middle age, wearing steel-rimmed glasses, summarized. "Unidentified flying objects called UFOs have been of intermittent concern to the CIA and the Air Force, especially in the 50s and 60s, in part because rumors about them might be a means for a hostile power to spread confusion or to overload communications channels. A few of the more reliably reported incidents turned out to be penetrations of U.S. airspace or overflights of U.S. overseas bases by high-performance aircraft from the Soviet Union or Cuba. Such overflights are a common means of testing a potential adversary's readiness. And the United States had more than its fair share of penetrations, and feints at penetration of Soviet airspace. A Cuban MiG penetrating 200 miles up the Mississippi Basin before being detected was considered undesirable publicity by NORAD. The routine procedure had been for the Air Force to deny that any of its aircraft were in the vicinity of the UFO sighting, and to volunteer nothing about unauthorized penetrations, thus solidifying public mystification. At these explanations, the Air Force Chief of Staff looked marginally uncomfortable, but said nothing. The great majority of UFO reports, the DCI continued, were natural objects misapprehended by the observer. Unconventional or experimental aircraft, automobile headlights reflected off overcast, balloons, birds, luminescent insects, even planets and stars seen under unusual atmospheric conditions had all been reported as UFOs. A significant number of reports turned out to be hoaxes or real psychiatric delusions. There had been more than 1 million UFO sightings reported worldwide since the term flying saucer had been invented in the late 40s, and not one of them seemed on good evidence to be connected with an extraterrestrial visitation. But the idea generated powerful emotions, and there were fringe groups and publications and even some academic scientists that kept alive the supposed connection between UFOs and life on other worlds. Recent millenarian doctrine included its share of saucer-borne extraterrestrial redeemers. The official Air Force investigation called in one of its final incarnations Project Blue Book, had been closed down in the 60s for lack of progress, although a low-level continuing interest had been maintained jointly by the Air Force and the CIA. The scientific community had been so convinced there was nothing to it that when Jimmy Carter requested the National Aeronautics and Space Administration to make a comprehensive study of UFOs, NASA uncharacteristically refused a presidential request. In fact, interjected one of the scientists at the table, unfamiliar with the protocol in meetings such as this, the UFO business has made it more difficult to do serious SETI work. All right, the president sighed. Is there anybody around this table who thinks UFOs and this signal from Vega have anything to do with each other? Derheer inspected his fingernails. No one spoke. Just the same, there's going to be an awful lot of I told you so's from the UFO yo-yos. Marvin, why don't you continue? In 1936, Ms. Presidentum, a very faint television signal transmits the opening ceremonies of the Olympic Games to a handful of television receivers in the Berlin area. It's an attempt at a public relations coup. It shows the progress and superiority of German technology. There were a few earlier TV transmissions, but all at very low power levels. Actually, we did it before the Germans. Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover made a brief television appearance on April 27th, 1927. Anyway, the German signal leaves the Earth at the speed of light. 26 years later, it arrives on Vega. They sit on the signal for a few years, whoever they are, and then send it back to us hugely amplified. Their ability to receive that very weak signal is impressive, and their ability to return it at such high power levels is impressive. There certainly are security implications here. The electronic intelligence community, for example, would like to know how such weak signals can be detected. Those people, or whatever they are in Vega, are certainly more advanced than we are. Maybe only a few decades further along, but maybe much further along than that. They've given us no other information about themselves, except at some frequencies, the transmitted signal doesn't show the Doppler effect from the motion of their planet around their star. They've simplified that data reduction step for us. They're helpful. So far, nothing of military or any other interest has been received. All they've been saying is that they're good at radio astronomy. They like prime numbers. And they can return our first TV transmissions back to us. It couldn't hurt for any other nation to know that. Oh, and remember, all those other countries are receiving this same 3-minute Hitler clip over and over again. They just haven't figured out how to read it yet. The Russians or the Germans or someone is likely to tumble to this polarization modulation sooner or later. My personal impression, Ms. President? I don't know if state agrees, is that it would be better if we released it to the world before we're accused of covering something up. If the situation remains static, with no big change from where we are right now, we could think about making a public announcement, or even releasing that 3-minute film clip. Oh, incidentally, we haven't been able to find any record from German archives of what was in that original broadcast. We can't be absolutely sure that the people on Vega haven't made some change in the content before sending it back to us. We can recognize Hitler all right, and the part of the Olympic Stadium we see corresponds accurately to Berlin in 1936. But if at that moment Hitler had really been scratching his mustache instead of smiling as in that transmission, we'd have no way to know. Ellie arrived, slightly breathless, followed by Valerian. They attempted to take obscure chairs against the wall, but Derheer noticed and directed the president's attention to them.
Dr. Arrowway, I'm glad to see you've arrived safely. First, let me congratulate you on a splendid discovery. Splendid. Marvin.
I've reached a stopping point, Miss President.
Good. Dr. Arrowway, we understand you have something new. Would you care to tell us about it?
Miss President, sorry to be late, but I think we've just hit the cosmic jackpot. Let me try and explain it this way. In classical times, thousands of years ago, when parchment was in short supply, people would write over an old parchment, making what's called a palimpsest. There was writing under writing under writing. This signal from Vega is, of course, very strong. As you know, there's the prime numbers, and underneath them, in what's called polarization modulation, this
eerie Hitler business. But underneath the sequence of prime numbers and underneath the retransmitted Olympic broadcast, we've just uncovered an incredibly rich message. At least we're pretty sure it's a message. As far as we can tell, it's been there all along. We've just detected it. It's weaker than the announcement signal, but I'm embarrassed we didn't find it sooner. What does it say? The president asked. What's it about? We haven't the foggiest idea, Miss President. Some of the people at Project Argus tumbled to it early this morning, Washington time. We've been working on it all night. Over an open phone? Asked Kitts. With standard commercial encryption. Ellie looked a little flushed. Opening her telefax case, she quickly generated a transparency printout and, with an overhead projector, cast its image against a screen. Here's all we know up to now. We'll get a block of information comprising about 1,000 bits. There'll be a pause, and then the same block will be repeated, bit for bit. Then there'll be another pause, and we'll go on to the next block. It's repeated as well. The repetition of every block is probably to minimize transmission errors. They must think it's very important that we get whatever it is they're saying down accurately. Now, let's call each of these blocks of information a page. Argus is picking up a few dozen of these pages a day. But we don't know what they're about. They're not a simple picture code like the Olympic message. This is something much deeper and much richer. It appears to be, for the first time, information they've generated. The only clue we have so far is that the pages seem to be numbered. At the beginning of every page, there's a number in binary arithmetic. Oh, see this one here? And every time another pair of identical pages shows up, it's labeled with the next higher number. Right now we're on page 10,413. That's a big book. Calculating back, it seems that the message began about 3 months ago. We're lucky to have picked it up as early as we did. I was right, wasn't I? Kitts leaned across the table to Drahir. This isn't the kind of message you want to give to the Japanese or the Chinese or the Russians, is it? Is it going to be easy to figure out? The president asked over the whispering Kitts. We will, of course, make our best efforts. And it probably would be useful to have the National Security Agency work on it also. But without an explanation from Vega, without a primer, my guess is that we're not going to make much progress. It certainly doesn't seem to be written in English or German or any other earthly language. Our hope is that the message will come to an end, maybe on page 20,000 or page 30,000, and then start right over from the beginning, so we'll be able to fill in the missing parts. Maybe before the whole message repeats, there'll be a primer, a kind of McGuffey's reader, that will enable us to understand the message. If I may, Miss President... Miss President, this is Dr. Peter Valerian of the California Institute of Technology, one of the pioneers in this field. Please go ahead, Dr. Valerian. This is an intentional transmission to us. They know we're here. They have some idea, from having intercepted our 1936 broadcast, of where our technology is, of how smart we are. They wouldn't be going to all this trouble if they didn't want us to understand the message. Somewhere in there is the key to help us understand it. It's only a question of accumulating all the data and analyzing it very carefully. Well, what do you suppose the message is about? I don't see any way to tell, Ms. President. I can only repeat what Dr. Arroway said. It's an intricate and complex message. The transmitting civilization is eager for us to receive it. Maybe all this is one small volume of the Encyclopedia Galactica. The star Vega is about 3 times more massive than the sun and about 50 times brighter. Because it burns its nuclear fuel so fast, it has a much shorter lifetime than the sun. Yes, maybe something's about to go wrong on Vega, the director of Central Intelligence interrupted. Maybe their planet will be destroyed. Maybe they want someone else to know about their civilization before they're wiped out. Or, offered Kitts, maybe they're looking for a new place to move to and the Earth would suit them just fine. Maybe it's no accident they chose to send us a picture of Adolf Hitler. Hold on, Ellie said. There are a lot of possibilities, but not everything is possible. There's no way for the transmitting civilization to know whether we've received the message, much less whether we're making any progress in decoding it. If we find the message offensive, we're not obliged to reply. And even if we did reply, it would be 26 years before they received the reply, and another 26 years before they can answer it. The speed of light is fast, but it's not infinitely fast. We're very nicely quarantined from Vega. And if there's anything that worries us about this new message, we have decades to decide what to do about it. Let's not panic quite yet. She enunciated these last words while offering a pleasant smile to Kitts. I appreciate those remarks, Dr. Arroway, returned the president. But things are happening fast, too damn fast. And there are too many maybes. I haven't even made a public announcement about all of this. Not even the prime numbers, never mind the Hitler bullcrap. Now we have to think about this book you say they're sending. And because you scientists think nothing of talking to each other, the rumors are flying. Phyllis, where's that file? Here, look at these headlines. Brandished successively at arm's length, they all carried the same message, with minor variations, in journalistic artistry. Space doc says radio show from bug-eyed monsters. Astronomical telegram hints at extraterrestrial intelligence. Voice from heaven? And, the aliens are coming, the aliens are coming! She let the clippings flutter to the table. At least the Hitler story hasn't broken yet. I'm waiting for those headlines. Hitler alive and well in space, U.S. says. And worse, much worse. I think we'd better curtail this meeting and reconvene later. If I may, Ms. President, Gerhier interrupted haltingly, with evident reluctance. I beg your pardon, but there are some international implications that I think have to be raised now. The president merely exhaled, acquiescing. Gerhier continued, Tell me if I have this right, Dr. Arroway. Every day the Star Vega rises over the New Mexico desert. And then you get whatever page of this complex transmission, whatever it is, they happen to be sending to the Earth at the moment. Then 8 hours later or something, the star sets. Right so far? Okay. Then the next day the star rises again in the east, but you've lost some pages during the time you weren't able to look at it after it had set the previous night, right? So it's as if you were getting pages 30 through 50 and then pages 80 through 100 and so on. No matter how patiently we observe, we're going to have enormous amounts of information missing. Gaps. Even if the message eventually repeats itself, we're going to have gaps. That's entirely right. Ellie rose and approached an enormous globe of the world. Evidently, the White House was opposed to the obliquity of the Earth. The axis of this globe was defiantly vertical. Tentatively, she gave it a spin. The Earth turns.
You need radio telescopes distributed evenly over many longitudes if you don't want gaps.
Any one nation observing only from its own territory is going to dip into the message and dip out. Maybe even at the most interesting parts. Now, this is the same kind of problem that an American interplanetary spacecraft faces. It broadcasts its findings back to Earth when it passes by some planet. But the United States might be facing the other way at the time.
So NASA has arranged for 3 radio tracking stations to be distributed evenly in longitude around the Earth.
Over the decades, they've performed superbly. But, her voice trailed off diffidently, and she looked directly at P.L. Garrison, the NASA administrator. A thin, sallow, friendly man, he blinked.
Thank you. Yes, it's called the Deep Space Network, and we're very proud of it. We have stations in the Mojave Desert, in Spain, and in Australia. Of course, we're underfunded, but with a little help, I'm sure we could get up to speed.
Spain and Australia? The president asked. For purely scientific work, the Secretary of State was saying.
I'm sure there's no problem. However, if this research program had political overtones, it might be a little tricky.
American relations with both countries had become cool of late.
There's no question this has political overtones, the president replied a little testily.
But, we don't have to be tied to the surface of the Earth, interjected an Air Force general. We can beat the rotation period. All we need is a large radio telescope in Earth orbit.
All right. The president again glanced around the table. Do we have a space radio telescope? How long would it take to get one up? Who knows about this, Dr. Garrison?
Ms. President, we at NASA have submitted a proposal for the Maxwell Observatory in each of the last 3 fiscal years, but OMB has removed it from the budget each time.
We have a detailed design study, of course, but it would take years. Well, 3 years anyway, before we could get it up. And I feel I should remind everybody that until last fall, the Russians had a working millimeter and submillimeter wave telescope in Earth orbit. We don't know why it failed, but they'd be in a better position to send some cosmonauts up to fix it than we'd be to build and launch one from scratch. That's it? The president asked. NASA has an ordinary telescope in space, but no big radio telescope. Isn't there anything suitable up there already? What about the intelligence community? National Security Agency? Nobody? So, just to follow this line of reasoning, Dürer said, it's a strong signal, and it's on lots of frequencies. After Vega sets over the United States, there are radio telescopes in half a dozen countries that are detecting and recording the signal. They're not as sophisticated as Project Argus, and they probably haven't figured out the polarization modulation yet. If we wait to prepare a space radio telescope and launch it, the message might be finished by then, gone altogether. So doesn't it follow that the only solution is immediate cooperation with a number of other nations, Dr. Arroway? I don't think any nation can accomplish this project alone. It will require many nations, spread out in longitude all the way around the Earth. It will involve every major radio astronomy facility now in place. The big radio telescopes in Australia, China, India, the Soviet Union, the Middle East, and Western Europe. It would be irresponsible if we wind up with gaps in the coverage because some critical part of the message came when there's no telescope looking at Vega. We'll have to do something about the Eastern Pacific between Hawaii and Australia, and maybe something about the Mid-Atlantic also. Well, the Director of Central Intelligence responded grudgingly. The Soviets have several satellite tracking ships that are good in S-band through X-band. The academic Keldysh, for example, or the Marshall Nedelin. If we make some arrangements with them, they might be able to station ships in the Atlantic or the Pacific and fill in the gaps. Ellie pursed her lips to respond, but the president was already talking. All right, Ken, you may be right. But I say again, this is moving too damn fast. There are some other things I have to attend to right now. Now, I'd appreciate it if the Director of Central Intelligence and the National Security Staff would work overnight on whether we have any options besides cooperation with other countries, especially countries that aren't our allies. I'd like the Secretary of State to prepare, in cooperation with the scientists, a contingency list of nations and individuals to be approached if we have to cooperate, and some assessment of the consequences. Is some nation going to be mad at us if we don't ask them to listen? Can we be blackmailed by somebody who promises the data and then holds back?
Should we try to get more than one country at each longitude?
Work through the implications, and for God's sake, her eyes moved from face to face around the long, polished table. Keep quiet about this. You too, Arroway. We've got problems enough.
Chapter 7 The Ethanol in W3. No credence whatever is to be given to the opinion that the demons act as messengers and interpreters between the gods and men to carry all petitions from us to the gods and to bring back to us the help of the gods. On the contrary, we must believe them to be spirits most eager to inflict harm, utterly alien from righteousness, swollen with pride, pale with envy, subtle in deceit. Augustine, The City of God, 8:22. That heresies should arise, we have the prophecy of Christ. But that old ones should be abolished, we hold no prediction. Thomas Brown, Religio Medici, 1:8:1642. She had planned to meet Vega's plane in Albuquerque and drive him back to the Argus facility in the Thunderbird. The rest of the Soviet delegation would have traveled in the observatory cars. She would have enjoyed speeding to the airport in the cool dawn air, perhaps again past an honor guard of rampant conies. And she had been anticipating a long and substantive private talk with Vega on the return. But the new security people from the General Services Administration had vetoed the idea. Media attention and the president's sober announcement at the end of her press conference 2 weeks before had brought enormous crowds to the isolated desert site. There was a potential for violence, they had told Ellie. She must in future travel only in government cars, and then only with discreetly armed escorts. Their little convoy was wending its way toward Albuquerque at a pace so sober and responsible that she found her right foot of its own volition depressing an imaginary accelerator on the rubber mat before her. It would be good to spend some time with Vega again. She had last seen him in Moscow 3 years before, during one of those periods in which he was forbidden to visit the West. Authorization for foreign travel had waxed and waned through the decades in response to changing policy fashions and Vega's own unpredictable behavior. Permission would be denied him after some mild political provocation about which he seemed unable to restrain himself, and then granted again when no one of comparable ability could be found to flesh out one or another scientific delegation. He received invitations from all over the world for lectures, seminars, colloquia, conferences, joint study groups, and international commissions. As a Nobel laureate in physics, and as a full member of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, he could afford to be a little more independent than most. He often seemed poised precariously at the outer limits of the patience and restraint of the governmental orthodoxy. His full name was Vasily Grigorievich Lunacharsky, known throughout the global community of physicists as Vega, after the initials of his first name and patronymic. His fluctuating and ambiguous relations with the Soviet regime puzzled her and others in the West. He was a distant relative of Anatoly Vasilyevich Lunacharsky, an old Bolshevik colleague of Gorky, Lenin, and Trotsky. The elder Lunacharsky had served as People's Commissar for Education and as Soviet ambassador to Spain until his death in 1933. Vega's mother had been Jewish. He had, it was said, worked on Soviet nuclear weapons, although surely he was too young to have played much of a role in fashioning the first Soviet thermonuclear explosion. His institute was well-staffed and well-equipped, and his scientific productivity was prodigious, indicating at most infrequent distractions by the Committee for State Security. Despite the ebb and flow of permission for foreign travel, he had been a frequent attendee at major international conferences, including the Rochester Symposia on High Energy Physics, the Texas meetings on relativistic astrophysics, and the informal but occasionally influential Pugwash scientific gatherings on ways of reducing international tension. In the 1960s, she had been told, Vega visited the University of California at Berkeley and was delighted with the proliferation of irreverent, scatological, and politically outrageous slogans imprinted on inexpensive buttons. You could, she recalled with faint nostalgia, size up someone's most pressing social concerns at a glance. Buttons were also popular and fiercely traded in the Soviet Union, but usually they celebrated the Dynamo soccer team or one of the successful spacecraft of the Luna series, which had been the first spacecraft to land on the moon. The Berkeley buttons were different. Vega had bought dozens of them, but delighted in wearing one in particular. It was the size of his palm and read, Pray for Sex. He even displayed it at scientific meetings. When asked about its appeal, he would say, In your country, it is offensive in only one way. In my country, it is offensive in two independent ways. If pressed further, he would only comment that his famous Bolshevik relative had written a book on the place of religion in a socialist society. Since then, his English had improved enormously, much more than Ellie's Russian. But his propensity for wearing offensive lapel buttons had sadly diminished. End of side 5.